Tonight, Fox presents a world premiere motion picture from the creators of the hit comic book series The X-Men comes Generation X. They've got the power. They've got the technology. They're the new generation of superheroes. And they're coming. To save the world.
You can't win.
Hey, shut up! I'm here, God!
Get ready for Generation X on the Fox Tuesday Night Movie.
Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to any and all canceled TV shows in the sci-fi, fantasy, and horror genre. And tonight we are covering the comic book genre. Mr. Zeneca and I did this once before in a break in between a couple seasons. We decided to cover the Doctor Strange pilot movie back from the 70s, which was supposed to be a ongoing TV show, which never ended up happening. And Mr. Zeneca is working for a nightclub right now to get ready for Friday the 13th, as well as dealing with some medical issues. And we are going to be starring Powerless coming up on the DC Comics show at some point in September. But in the meantime, I thought I would do this one-off Generation X pilot and make my friend Chandra suffer through it with me, as well as a gentleman named Lee, who is recommended by Adam from the Wizards Podcast Guide to Comic Books. Introduce yourself, Lee.
Hey, how's it going?
Introduce yourself.
Oh, all right. A little bit more. My name's Lee. I'm a lifelong comic book fan. I'm a cartoonist, illustrator. I do my own mini comics and stuff like that, including one called Tales from the Fridge, which is about a talking can of meat named Imitation Meat Guy. So, okay. I grew up reading comics in the 90s. So right at the heyday of Generation X popularity, it came out in 1994 and I collected the entire run of Gen X, so I remember watching this TV movie on television when it premiered back in 1996, and looking forward to talking about it.
And Chandra, you are a cosplayer of many things. Is Domino the only thing you've cosplayed as from the X-Men universe?
No, I do Storm. I've done...
That's right, you did Storm.
I do
Storm. Yeah.
My hair is literally cut in her style now.
You need to cut that thing into a mohawk and do Mohawk Storm.
Oh, that's definitely what I've been rocking. My hair is now most definitely a mohawk. I have been rocking it all weekend, and that's what everybody's been calling me. And currently it's picked out to high heaven, so I have a frohawk right now.
There you go. Awesome. Well, I made you both suffer through this terrible, terrible movie, and we're going to go over a plot synopsis real quick about Generation X, the movie. It was directed by Max Schulder, and it premiered on February 20th, 1996. It's based on the Marvel comic book of series of the same name and spinoff from the X-Men franchise, self-contained in its own universe. A selected private school for mutants, kids are targeted by two adult mutants, the filthy rich Emma Frost and Sean Cassidy Banshee, an Irishman who has a sonic scream capable of splitting steel. And the villain of the story is Russell Tresh, played by Matt Frewer, an egomaniacal scientist who used to work with Emma Frost to develop abilities for mutants, or possibly a mutant cure, and uses dream technology to get inside people's heads, a la very much like Jim Carrey's character, the Riddler, in Batman Forever. Through multiple machinations and a 90210 plotline, the kids get into all sorts of trouble, but in the end, they're able to defeat Tresh and form Generation X to spin off to a television series, which unfortunately we never do get. And that is the basic plot of the show. Why don't we go through the cast of characters real quick of who everybody is in the show? Starting with you, Chandra, who did you recognize from this plot line of mutant characters that are well-known?
So it was obviously Jubilee and Emma Frost, okay. The ones that I knew the most.
All right. A lot of people in other reviews kept commenting about Emma Frost in the original X-Men show, and I have to correct everybody who obviously never watched the original X-Men show because their reviews are filled with stupidity. Emma Frost appeared in two episodes of the X-Men original animated series. She was not that big of a character until Generation X came along. She was kind of like a background X-Men villain that it would appear sporadically here and there, but mostly with the BDSM Hellfire, Adults Only Hellfire Club. And they were basically dished out like chess pieces. There was a black queen, a king, a white king, white queen, and that's who Emma Frost was. And after the Hellions were killed in the comic books, she joined Xavier's school as kind of a frenemy. And her and Sean Cassidy, after a big X-Men crossover event, would start Generation X up in Salem, Massachusetts, a little further away than Westchester, New York, where the Xavier Institute is. I knew who all these characters were just because I was reading X-Men at the time, so I knew most of the ones that I was familiar with, which was Sean Cassidy, Banshee, who had appeared in X-Men prior, and he was on the animated series for a few episodes, and of course Jubilee, who was in almost every episode of the animated series, and that's where I really encountered her from. In fact, I wrote Jubilee fan fiction when I was in high school, that a vampire mutant comes to the school, and him and Jubilee run off together, and the X-Men have to go chase him down, and eventually have to kill him, or Wolverine does, which is funny enough, because years later, Jubilee would actually become a vampire, and Kid Quagmire would use the Phoenix Force to cure her of her vampirism, and she would return to her mutant status. She was not a mutant when she became a vampire because of the events of M-Day. Lee, you were familiar with the X-Men comic book Generation X, so you knew who a lot of these characters were?
Yeah, I dug head in when Generation X came out. I remember Marvel released a preview collector's edition that came out a few months before the book actually came out, and it gave you a rundown of all the characters. And the big thing about it was the creators Scott Lobdell and Chris Pacello, they both really clung to the fact that these were not your normal everyday mutant. Like, you had one whose, you know, skin had 6 feet of extra skin. You had Chamber, whose face was missing half of it because his chest blew out the first time his mutant ability happened. So he just had a big old ball of fire. And then I saw previews for the movie, and I saw characters like Refrax, who was essentially Cyclops. Like, what if we had Billy Idol play Cyclops? And then Buff, which essentially replaced Husk, Paige Guthrie. Buff, the character, her name was Arlie Hicks, which, I mean, and that's what Paige Guthrie was. She was a Southern Hick. So they kind of were a little tongue-in-cheek with that name. But it was a little intense to see this movie on television not recognize some of the main characters, so.
And Paige's brother is Cannonball, correct?
Yes. I believe there's one other sibling out of the family that's an X-Man, but I can't remember which one off the top of my head.
Yeah, there's three kids. They're all mutants. One's Paige, one's Sam, and then one's like an Angel kind of ripoff character.
Oh, all right.
Did either one of you recognize anyone from the cast besides Matt Frewer, who is best known for Bax Headroom, and of course the remake of Dawn of the Dead, directed by Zack Snyder, and of course Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Overall, it was a lot of no-name people. I do remember seeing Augustin Rodriguez, who played Skin, shortly after. I think he was in the movie Strange Days with Ralph Fiennes. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, that's Skin. I'm probably the only person that watched Strange Days and thought that. So,
Chandra?
No, the only one that I recognized were the popular names, and that's because they were in things later that I've watched. Other than that, I knew none of these kids, and I don't think I've seen any of them in anything else afterwards.
Finola Hughes, who plays Emma Frost, is the only person I recognize because I used to watch General Hospital with my mother, and she is still on General Hospital to this very day with 1,757 fucking episodes. Jesus Christ.
It's like One Piece.
1985 to 2024 currently, she is still on that show. She plays Anna Devone, Ava Jerome, and Alex Merrick. So she's played three different characters on the show. I'm assuming one of these is still like alive. Unbelievable. She was also on All My Children for 121 episodes as well. She was Laura in Staying Alive, which is funny because she's also the voice of Laura, Superman's mother, Lor-El, in Superman the Animated Series for the origin episodes of Superman the Animated Series. So she did play a comic book character prior to playing this, because Superman the Animated Series would debut a few months prior to Generation X, the movie.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Didn't realize that.
Weird comic book connection as well. She was on Blossom. She played Carol for 27 episodes. Very important character on that show. Blossom was developed and created by the late, great Bill Bixby.
Was the character she played, if I remember right, did she play the girlfriend of Blossom's dad?
Yes, Blossom's dad was a single father. Of course, a lot of people know that Blossom herself, Mayim Bialik, would go on to play Amy Farrah Fowler on The Big Bang Theory, another geeky, very Hendrix show. But yes, her dad was a single father, and this was the girlfriend of her father.
I was never a Blossom. I was Sabrina.
That's fine. I was a big Sabrina fan, too. What was funny is that I just got done talking about, in the movie From Dusk Till Dawn, one of the victims, one of the kidnapped girls at the very beginning of the movie in the gas station liquor store that Quentin Tarantino and George Clooney have, she appeared on several episodes of Sabrina the Teenage Witch as kind of like a background female classmate of Sabrina's. I thought that was very funny. But anyway, so yeah, this cast is very much like unknown in terms of anything. I've reached out to both Jeremy Ratchford, who played Sean Cassidy, and Finola until I realized how big of a star she was on General Hospital. She was never going to come on this podcast. That's not necessary to say that I can't have these type of people on the show, because I've had John J. York, and he's been on General Hospital for 1,000 episodes on my show. Another big comic book tie-in, Gary Chalk is in this. He plays Detective Gaines for one scene, and Gary Chalk would go on to play Dum Dum Dungan, the co-head of S.H.I.E.L.D. on Nick Fury, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a made-for-TV movie that would be on the Fox network in 3 years.
I actually remember that he showed up and recognized him from Generation X, which is pretty funny. It was a weird time for Fox at that time, because they were trying to really come off with a lot of these Marvel with these two Marvel made-for-TV movies, and then they also followed that up with the Doctor Who made-for-TV movie as well.
Yes, then my Doctor Who made-for-TV movie, which everyone scoffed at, but then years later, in the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, they officially made recognized as canon, as they had that actor show up in the to transform into the War Doctor.
Very, very crazy.
Yeah. But Gary Chalk at this time was also pulling double duty over on syndication, as he was the voice of Optimus Primal, the leader of the Maximals on Transformers Beast Wars.
How about that? Didn't I realize that?
Yeah, definitely. So why don't we start getting into the plot, and then we'll go over, like, as characters appear and, like, who they are. We begin this in a laboratory as Matt Frewer and Emma Frost are working together. And they talk about their test subject is in violation of the Mutant Registration Act. Chandra, are you familiar with the Mutant Registration Act?
So the Mutant Registration Act is when you reach age or puberty and you get your powers, you have to go register. So people know that you have mutant powers and you're registered in levels of mutant ability. I believe it's 1 through 3?
No, like 1 through 10.
Oh, see, I only was familiar with the first three.
No, it's not even. No, it's not numbers. It's Omega level and downward. Omega is the top you can be. Like Iceman is an Omega level mutant because his ability to control ice and water makes him that Omega level type of mutant. Magneto, obviously. What was that? Sorry.
I said I have it in levels in my head. See.
Yes. Wolverine is not considered an Omega-level mutant, by the way, because his mutant ability is just being a healing factor. He just happens to have a berserker rage and be out of control and things like that. That's not a mutant power. He's just a psychopath. Charles Xavier is considered an Omega-level mutant. Jean Grey, Storm, Apocalypse. Cyclops is not considered an Omega-level mutant. Rogue is not considered an Omega-level mutant. There's Gambit. You know, a lot of the core X-Men are not considered Omega-level mutants, but Iceman is. Because of his ability to control ice and water. So
you would think that Jubilee was the most powerful mutant with the way that Matt Frewer's character tries to pursue her throughout this movie.
Yes, very icky.
Because of her latent psychic powers, because she had the duel.
Oh, yes.
So they switch over to Jubilee at the mall, and we all know like Jubilee is this like mall rat. This is, by the way, after we get Emma causing people headaches and Hector leaving home with his sister grabbing onto his arm, which comes up in a very disgusting scene later on with Matt Frewer making threats to him that he was going to mind rape his sister. And I had to rewatch that scene 3 times to make sure he actually said the words, "I'm going to mind rape your sister." This is the censors at Fox just being like, okay.
I was amazed in a rewatch of this how much they got away with in terms of the stuff that Matt Frewer's character did and said.
Yep. So make you hate him even more.
And the thing that also blew my mind, kind of backtracking a tiny bit, was that the movie starts almost exactly the same as the 2000 X-Men movie, with the definition of mutants almost exactly the same as from the actual movie by Bryan Singer.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get to the biggest connection of them all. At the X-Men, at the arcade where Jubilee is doing her little mall rat thing. By the way, I'm only going to say it once. Matt Frewer sounds like Jim Carrey this entire time. Chandra.
I'm here.
Okay, your thing keeps going on mute.
Yeah, it's because I have a lot of background noise, so I'm trying to omit it.
I don't hear anything from you, so don't worry about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, stop being on mute so you can jump in and say something. I digress. I'll edit this part out. Does anyone notice what's in the background of the arcade that Jubilee's playing at?
No, I was too busy focusing on the video game because it's Mortal Kombat.
In the background behind Matt Frewer is X-Men the arcade game.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. It was that, and then just Sega must have put a ton of money into this because Virtual Fighter is everywhere.
Well, if you look up old ads for this for the Generation X in both copies of like Wizard and Game Pro and any X-Men comic books or any Marvel comic that was coming out at this time, this was around the time of the Onslaught storyline, the Heroes Reborn, and the end of the Clone Saga, just to put it in perspective of what was going on in the Marvel Universe in 1996. This ad was heavily featured, and Sega was on the ad.
That makes so much more sense. I remember at the time watching it and just being like, apparently the producers were just very big fans of Virtual Fighter. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It is very funny, though, just the way that they introduced Jubilee in this is they knew what they were working with because they went and introduced her exactly the same way as they did in the cartoon.
Yes and no. So she's got like three different ways that she goes about. In the comic book, she's introduced by rescuing Wolverine from the scene that we saw in Deadpool Wolverine where he's crucified on the Giant X, but she's a runaway with no parents. In the cartoon, she is a orphan living with foster parents, and in this, she seems to have biological parents. For an Asian girl, she's got pretty white parents.
Yes. Yes, they definitely, unfortunately, whitewashed the character of Jubilee for this movie.
A little bit. Chandra, did you have anything you want to say?
Not unless you want me to go on a tirade about how much I can't stand Jubilee in general now.
Oh, why do you hate Jubilee?
Oh my god. I have had this thing with Jubilee for so long. I disdain her. It's her mutant powers. I often equate her to the Booster Gold of the mutants. I have never seen, like, her powers are cool. Don't get me wrong. I like shiny things. I like distractions. But I have never, and I like her as a person. It's her powers. I think they screwed her on powers. I don't like them. I've never liked her just because of that one reason. And it's the stupidest reason. I just can't look with the sparkly fingertips. It's Booster Gold of the mutants, and it drives me nuts.
So Sean Cassidy and Emma Frost are fucking in this movie, and they are a couple in the comic books. Sean Cassidy and Cyclops are the only two big conquests that I'm aware of the White Queen has had. So I knew that they were together in the comics at this time because they did found Generation X together. It's funny to see them like brought to live action as the first two live action X-Men characters, not counting people in parades, not counting people in commercials, not counting promo ads for video games, things like that. Not all of that aside, and obviously animation aside, these are the first two live action X-Men characters. And it's funny that we get mention of Charles Xavier and the Xavier Institute. Later on, there's a scene where Emma, the reason why she's pushing these kids so hard is because she lost the Hellions. And that did happen in the comics as well. So it was really interesting, despite how bad this movie is, and this movie is bad, it's terrible, they really put a lot of care into making sure that the script for this thing actually felt like it was paying attention to mutant in the X-Men comic books. And I know, Chandra, you were like completely just not buying Emma Frost. Was it the accent, or was it her clothes? Was it her awesome hair?
It was everything. She wasn't Emma Frost enough.
She wasn't like, that she much just, of a bitch.
Yeah, she was very, like, nurturing and, like, mothery, and she wasn't, like, she was off, and her clothes were off, and she was, no, it was AliExpress Emma Frost.
Well, this is what Emma Frost was wearing in Generation X, by the way.
Yeah, this is exactly, I would say this is straight off the page.
Yeah, no, when she became Emma Frost's teacher, she had to put some clothes on. Now, there is a very funny remark that Kitty makes against her in Astonishing X-Men number 1, which was written by the problematic Joss Whedon, but this is a very funny line, that when Emma Frost says, Miss Pride, did we forget what time class begins? And she goes, I don't know, Miss Frost, did we forget where the rest of that costume is? Like, one for Kitty. And later on, of course, Emma's sleeping with Cyclops, and Cyclops wakes up and Wolverine's sitting on the perch of the bed, and Jean has only been dead probably for a couple months now, second time Jean's died, and he goes, what part of mourning is this, Slim?
Yeah, I will say the one thing, I mean, like you said, the movie's not good, but I will say both Jeremy Ratchford and Fiona looked the parts, especially Fiona, she looked great as White Queen, and Jeremy Ratchford looked like Sean Cassidy did in the comics at that time as well. He had the goatee going. I will say his accent a couple times.
Awful.
It was so strong and forced. It's just like, oh my gosh, man, tone it down a bit. Like, it's pretty hilarious.
Did anybody recognize where they live?
The exact same as from the X2, X3, Deadpool. It's the same mansion they've used for almost all of the X-Men movies.
Almost all of the X-Men movies. I think there's only one or two it's slightly changed. And X-Men Days of Future Past, they don't really use it that much, so it's not, there's not enough wide of a shot to determine that they're actually using it. But I digress. Yeah. This is the X-Men actual mansion from the movies, which I think is a great little piece of... there's no continuity between this and the other film, but a great connection that obviously somebody worked on this film that worked on Bryan Singer's films. And of course, this would also be the same for Luther's Mansion in Smallville.
Yep.
It must be the only mansion in Vancouver, someone said.
It definitely has to be.
Apparently it also appears on Supernatural for one or two episodes. Someone said it's the mansion from the Clue episode where Sam and Dean do go to investigate that Bobby has been left a fortune and they have to like play through like a Clue kind of mystery. They don't play the game, but it's all of the jokes of Clue are there. They even realize that they're holding the candlestick and the rope and the revolver. So things like that. So I thought that was fantastic. One thing I didn't quite understand, what was up with the nude scanning? It's not so sexy anymore.
You know, I thought that scene, the whole nude scene, or not nude scene, the nude scanning scene was kind of like, hey, they didn't even give them any sort of introduction to the house. They've taken this, and I believe Jubilee in this movie is 15. They've taken this 15-year-old girl, and they got this student from California, and they don't even say, hey, here's your room, here's this. It's walk in, take your shirt off, we need to scan. I was like, man, that's pretty intense.
And Emma Frost swabs her skin but doesn't tell her why she's swabbing her skin and gives her no privacy while she's like that being scanned?
It's just something out of lesbian pornography. We'll just assume the actress playing Jubilee is older and she's supposed to be playing younger because that's cute in porn, and then the next scene they're making out.
Well, and it's like, it's...
And the two males can over. See her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The skin's over to skin, and he's like, all right, man, free show. And I'm like, oh, come on, what is happening right now?
Who is wannabe Cyclops with the glasses?
Refrax.
Okay, so Refrax and them, are they're all playing football, and later on he admits to Skin that he copped the feel of Paige, Husk.
Yeah, I believe he says she was solid.
Yes, like... Yeah. What the F? Even back then, I would have been like, no, not okay.
Yeah.
And then he's bragging that he will be able to see through their clothes.
I mean, well, that has been a trope since, like, Porky's and the hole in the wall to the girl's shower of teen dramas.
Yeah. I don't know what version I watched of the movie, but the version I watched had cussing in it.
Yes.
It dropped the F-bomb a few times. Then... there's a scene outside a bathroom, and Refrax makes a joke about seeing through the doors when Buff is in there and says, is that you, nice beaver? And I was like, what? just happened.
The actress who plays Jean Lee, by the way, she's the only character I really care about besides Emma Frost and Sean Cassidy. Matt Frewer's character, I feel like he was supposed to be a Jim Carrey ripoff because Jim Carrey had just done Batman Forever before this, and he acts exactly like the way he is in that movie. But I digress. Yeah.
Exactly.
And also, FYI, let's just get it out of the way right now. The entire Dream plotline, the director of this directed what is considered the worst of the Nightmare films. It's also considered the gayest horror movie of the 80s, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge. This film is not great compared to Nightmare Part 1 and what comes after it, which is Nightmare Part 3. This is the one where we have Jesse, the closet kid, you know what I mean? He wants to get away from his girlfriend and sleep with his best friend, and there's a lot of gay subtext in the film, and the actor would later on come out as gay and talk about his career and the whole documentary about him, and he blames the director for making this somewhat gay nightmare film but being all subtext or whatever and things like that. Well, that director would make this movie and also Wishmaster 2 and other terrible movies that are direct to DVD. So that's where a lot of the Dream crap comes from. But the actress who plays... let me just get to the actress who plays Jubilee. Yeah. The actress who plays Jubilee, by the way, is stunningly gorgeous, but she is not Asian. She's from Barnegat, New Jersey, and she doesn't look Asian at all. Her name's Heather McComb. She might be Asian. I don't really know. It just doesn't really look that way in the film. There's, by the way, she's still acting this very day. She's been in tons of things. The IMDb list goes on and on and on and on and on, all the way back to actually Alien Nation, the TV show. So kudos to her. But in response to Jubilee being Asian, the actress who played Jubilee in the X-Men 97 cartoon series left the role the actress who played Jubilee in the original X-Men animated series left the role for a different actress for X-Men 97 because she felt as though an Asian should play Jubilee. But she does come back to play Jubilee in a Mojo World future version of herself to help the regular Jubilee and Sunspot defeat Mojo.
Yeah, that was Allison Course, who also played the clown on Big Comfy Couch.
Yep. But she's a longtime voice actress, still working to this day as well, so... moving on to the plot line, a lot of Dream talk, it's Dream travel, Dream world, and the Dream Master is even dropped as well. Just weird Dream stuff that just overpowers this plot line to a 10th degree.
So it's kind of crazy because, at the time when Generation X came out, they had created, their own Magneto for Generation X to fight. And that was a character by the name of M-Plate. And M-Plate was kind of like a psionic vampire who would like suck the energy from mutants. But he also had vampire teeth in his hands, and he had a little person that was kind of like a ghoul that was his chauffeur and stuff. In watching this movie, it was kind of it's a little disjarring because you see the way it's filmed with Matt Frewer, everything with the lights, the way Frewer's character is, the dream sequence, the subliminal messaging, it is almost 100% Batman Forever in terms of so many decisions they made with this movie. And I almost got to imagine it's because that was the biggest comic book movie at that time.
Mm. Yeah, something was definitely influenced by it.
Yeah, there's just so many sideways angles and so many green lights, like just neon lights abound in this movie. It's crazy.
Mm. Chandra?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you have anything you wanted to add?
I was just looking something up.
By the way, just jump in as soon as someone's done talking. Just jump in with something you want to say. Don't wait for a prompt.
Oh, well, you were talking about, actors on the show that have continued to go on to, act. Bumper Robinson, who played, Mondo, he has done a lot of voice acting stuff. He hasn't physically been in things, but he's done like Spidey and Amazing Friends, Batman, The Caped Crusader. He's been acting. He does a lot of voiceover stuff. Final Fantasy, Suicide Squad.
Who is he in Final Fantasy?
In Final Fantasy, he played just some additional voices in that game in Reaper. But like in Suicide Squad, killed the Justice. He was Deadshot, and he's done Lego movies.
Oh, wow.
The Avengers. He was Captain America. Hellboy Wayward. He was Benson. He's in Starfield, Elder Scrolls. He does voices there. Star Trek, Harriet the Spy, which is based on a book. It's a kid's thing, obviously.
It's Michelle Trachtenberg. I knew that's how I knew who she was before she joined the cast of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. Well, he's literally has been acting since then. He's just physically hasn't appeared. I went down the rabbit hole looking at the other actors. Kevin McNulty, who we've seen in a bunch of things since then. I think Gary Chalk I've seen in a few things. But a couple of these girls, let's see, Jenny, I think that was the girlfriend, right? Or the one, his love interest?
Who? What?
Jenny? Jolene Collins?
In this movie?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, during their there's a sequence in this movie, the music sounds like the opening of Friends. Anyone catch that?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, and Friends debuted, what, like a year prior to this, right?
Yeah,
1995?
Yeah,
Friends just debuted, and it was beginning to blow up, like the phenomenon it would become.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
She was, like, Coded, which was, like, 6 episodes, because I wanted to see them, like, because some of them, like, now looking at, like, their updated pictures on IMBD, I was like, they look a little familiar. Let me take a closer look. Some of them have done a lot of voice acting stuff or behind the scene, like the Mall Rat was, I think you've seen that, said this before, was Tyler Labine.
Mm.
He's been in a lot of stuff.
Yes. Background people going on to bigger and better things.
Yeah. So like that was going down that rabbit hole, but it seems the most active was Mondo, who is Bumper Robinson. He's the voice actor.
Well, because Chandra loved this movie so much, she's 100% agreed to do Nick Fury Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with me. Right, Chandra?
Ooh.
If you want to be super glued to a wall, I guess I can do it.
I mean, that's got to be one of David Goyer's top movies right there.
Yeah, David Goyer goes on to write the Batman Dark Knight trilogy. It's hit or miss, but I think it's better in terms of production quality compared to this movie. Also, David Hasselhoff can chew the scenery in anything.
Oh, he really can.
I think he would have made a great Nick Fury if that had gone the series, honestly.
I actually think Hasselhoff in that movie is a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people are more associated with the black Nick Fury, which Marvel ended up doing their own little retcon of, saying that like Nick Fury, you know, had a black girlfriend, so he's got a black son, so they can have a black Nick Fury in the Marvel Universe, because the Ultimate Nick Fury got wiped out of existence when the Ultimate Universe was destroyed during Secret Wars. So we do have our two versions of Nick Fury. We have Old Man Fury, and we have young, hip black Fury, so... I digress. Chandra, have you ever seen the Captain America movie from 1990?
No, I was 3 when that came out.
Okay, so this is J.D. Salinger, the Catcher in the Rye author. This is his son trying to be an actor, and one of his first big roles is playing Steve Rogers, a.k.a. Captain America, in a plot line that is very close to the comics until it's not anymore.
Yes, and he has rubber ears sculpted onto his headpiece instead of just having his real ears.
Right, totally. And our first live-action Red Skull, he's Italian, but he's a Red Skull
until
he gets plastic surgery. And then he looks like Jigsaw, if you know who that character is from Punisher lore.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Again, he looks like a Red Skull for a while, and it's like, wow, that looks better than even Hugo Weaving's rubber-faced makeup in Captain America the First Avenger, until he decides to get plastic surgery, and then he just looks like Jigsaw from Punisher comics. Anyway, so back to this terrible movie. The kids get arrested for being typical teenagers. There's this entire boardwalk scene. I had just got done watching The Lost Boys with my girlfriend over the weekend, so it was a whole boardwalk kind of feeling in my head. It makes me want to go visit the boardwalk.
Yeah, that whole scene, because prior to that scene with them having a fight with the townies, I guess you could call them, right?
Right.
In a very racist manner, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. The townies in that are definitely, they're not 90s kids. They came straight out of the 1950s. The first time you're introduced to these kids, it's in an old school soda shop. It's almost like it's in a completely different movie that they threw these Generation X kids into. But yeah, the kid comes and starts the one jock who's wearing like the typical school jacket, Letterman jacket, and he just starts throwing out like racist remarks and making fun of special needs, and it's a sight to behold. I don't know if
you mean it wasn't okay back then either. Oh,
yeah, 90s. Right. You're sitting here watching this movie, and they get into this fight, and I believe right before the fight, though, it was the first time Skin had entered the dream of the girl that he thought was beautiful. So like she was looking for him and found him. I don't understand why it became a giant issue as it did in the scene, except just to create some kind of conflict.
It's funny that Emma expels the students. That's tough love. There you go, Chandra. She's being the bitch you want her to be.
It was, to me, it was still like, okay, you guys, like, you know, like, oh, do you use your mutant powers? Oh, no? Well, I'm gonna punish you anyway because I know you're lying. And then, like, they tell the one kid's, like, swallowed a rock or absorbed a rock, whatever the situation may be. But it was like, it wasn't... Emma Frost is a hard ass. She's not soft, and I don't like seeing her like that. Her clothes are fine. I don't really care about that. It didn't complete the entire package for me for Emma Frost, if that makes sense. Like she was just lackluster.
I mean, she does have the look, considering that hair, that wig she's wearing is straight out of what Emma's always had in the comics, which is nice. And she does have the cleavage too, because Emma Frost and cleavage go hand in hand.
Most Marvel females have some robust areas.
Right, but this is always, like, how she's drawn. This is why, like, when a character like this, now that Disney is in full control, people are wondering, it's just like, they, like, you know, women like to see the sex appeal, the empowerment that they give themselves. And this is why, like, characters like Black Cat and Emma Frost, you know what I mean, who use their feminine wiles to get what they want from their male good guys, are going to be played down, and you know, they're going to have some problems whenever Disney gets around to it. However, X-Men 97 comes out, and boy, oh boy, that cartoon was pretty titillating.
Yep.
I mean, Jesus Christ.
That Rogue booty.
Well, okay, yeah, Rogue was toned down a lot. I'm not going to get into that. I admit that was weird, but they toned down Rogue's curves and bust. But they give them all to the Goblin Queen, the clone of Jean Grey. I mean, when she puts on her super duper dominatrix costume, it is all centered on the light shining in areas. You know what I mean?
I gotta be honest, I haven't got to X-Men 97 yet.
It's like the third episode of the show. Yeah, the Black Queen shows up, and even the toy that came out, people were like, "Woo, the toy is hot." Waifu mommy.
Yeah, it's funny when they made the generation. So Toy Biz made the Generation X toy line in 1996, I believe.
I was just at somebody's house who had every single action figure. Go on.
I have them all, but there was two variations they did of Emma Frost. And one of the variations, her thighs were painted skin tone, and the other one it was all white. And that was a hot button issue. I remember that they showed her bare thighs.
Interesting. Even though in this, again, this costume change, she's now a teacher, so she's a little bit more conservative in her costume.
Yes, very much so.
Which, after this, she would join the X-Men full-time when Generation X's comic book ended in time for Grant Morrison to take over, and she's in that stupid-looking X-bra.
There's no way that suit would function in any way.
It's just low hideous-looking. Also, I'm not a big fan of how, what's the name of that, Frank Quitely? He draws people ugly.
Yeah, he definitely puts a lot of if the person has any sort of fold in their face, he's gonna accentuate that fold so much.
I mean, I love his All-Star Superman, but I think his artwork definitely changed for that. So
absolutely.
Chandra, are you familiar with what I'm talking about with the Grant Morrison run of X-Men?
No, I'm not. I was heavy into the Uncanny.
Okay, so Grant Morrison is the guy who created Cassandra Nova, the villain for Deadpool Wolverine.
Okay.
Yes, but in that, she's as old as Charles Xavier is. Don't forget, she is supposed to be as old as Charles. So if Patrick is in his 80s It should have been, like, a lot of people commented, this should be an 80-year-old bald woman, not a smoking hot supermodel.
Listen, so some of those grannies, they be packing, and you can't tell they're 80. So, I mean,
you gotta
the actress who played Cassandra is 25.
The way they explain that away now is just to say, oh, multiverse.
Oh, yeah, she's James McAvoy's twin sister, not Patrick Stewart. Because Patrick Stewart is 85 years old. Again, people are like, you should have cast, if she was still alive, you should have cast Angela Lansbury to play her and shave her bald. And I'm like, honestly, Angela Lansbury would have been a perfect Cassandra Nova.
If we were to get, I mean, the X-Men continuity in the movies, if you consider the fact that James McAvoy, the first class was a prequel to the original 2000 X-Men. The characters are all over the place where, with the age they should have been, so.
Correct. So after a lot more dreamy, chatty chat, talky talk, that leaves the movie on a cliffhanger to set up that Matt's going to come back as the big bad. The kids reconcile at the mansion, and we get our first actual X-Men costume with the woman who is hiding her body under bulky clothing, who's actually, like, super-duper strong and fit, comes out wearing the skin-tight, traditional-looking Generation X costume. And this is what the costume the Generation X kids would wear. They would all wear this bright red spandex, and Jubilee, of course, would wear her traditional yellow trench coat over it in the comics.
Yes, at the time, I was so excited to finally see a Generation X costume in live action. But you look at it now.
Yeah. And it's the same way that X-Men Age of X-Men Apocalypse ends, with all of the kids finally in X-Men costumes.
Yeah.
And actual X-Men costumes, too, not black leather.
It's an actual X-Men costume. I was like, well, they did what they could do to give you a comic accurate representation of the costume, for better or worse.
Right.
Because there's some parts where I'm like, yeah, it's all right. And then it's like bright, bright, bright red.
Have you both seen Deadpool and Wolverine?
Yes.
Okay. So what was the biggest cheering moment in that entire movie? Wolverine putting the mask on finally?
I love that scene. I will say that for me, being the giant comic nerd I've been over the years, just the showing all the different Wolverines from different multiverses, and when they showed Age of Apocalypse Wolverine.
Right, but that scene, when he puts the mask on, did that have people on their feet cheering, like when catches the hammer?
Yeah, that had my theater erupted.
What about yours, Chandra?
My movie theater did not freak out at that. The one that
really
freaked out, yeah. We all bugged when we seen, like, Gambit and Blade.
Oh,
and
yeah, that was fun too. But I mean, that had a reaction. But I just felt like my theater, which was packed on a Sunday, so the film had been out now since Thursday, and I saw it late because I was at a film fest showing off a film that I made about a comic book legend who has passed away. And I saw it on Sunday with my son. Theater was still packed, the whole theater, which was great to see for Sunday, and that's why the movie is doing. You know, it just beat. The movie just got back its number one box office stance this weekend, beating out Alien Romulus, which dropped to number two, dropping another comic book movie, The Crow, to number nine.
Ugh. You know, I can't say enough horrible things about The Crow.
We're not going to get into it. That's not here or there. I'm never covering The Crow TV show because it's one and done season canceled, but I would have to actually suffer through that whole show, but I digress. That moment, it was my theater's just like everyone cheering to see Wolverine fully in costume from head to toe at long last, which is just chef's kiss. I mean, it's what we've waited for. I mean, we get Spider-Man and Tobey Maguire, you know what I mean? The theater cheered when that happened in 2002. So things like that, just, you know, fantastic. I don't remember people doing that when, like, Captain America finally put his costume on and we got to see the full costume, or Iron Man when he's fully suiting up or whatever. We saw that in the trailer. You know, you had to sell that trailer the first time. But seeing Wolverine fully masked.
Yeah, but we got spoiled with those movies because it was like by the end of, you know, halfway through the movie, those characters are fully in a.
Right, and Cap was on the cover of Entertainment Weekly fully in costume.
Yeah.
A year before the movie came out.
Yeah, to wait 25 years to see it now, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I think it's because we had, like, so many X-Men films where it's just the stupid black leather. you know, where he's in street clothes. And it's like, ugh, we want to see the costume. And we get it. And it works because it looks like a costume someone would wear that is you know, he's got the pouches and you know, the mobility. Not that he needs armor.
And it was kind of like at the end of, I believe it was X-Men Apocalypse. They finally put him in somewhat comic accurate costumes
right.
and then wiped it completely away with the next movie. I'm like, what are they doing?
Well, I fully hated this movie, and I'm glad it never went to series, but maybe if it went to series, it would have been given a bit more of a budget. I don't understand why it didn't go to series. It was planned to go to series, but who knows? I mean, were the ratings that bad? Apparently not. The ratings for this were not that terrible. It had enough of a ratings to go to series. Wizard Magazine covered it quite heavily about, you know, what happened to it, but I digress. If it had gone to series, would we have ever gotten Bryan Singer's X-Men movies? Who knows?
I believe at one point they were going to do a Generation X animated series. And all that really survives of that was Fox Kids did an upfront with the logo for a Generation X animated series, but that was all that ever showed for it.
And by the way, the cartoon, the series was still running at this time. It had like a year left, so
yep,
it was in its final run of episodes, I think. So, I digress. Thank you everyone for joining for the Generation X coverage on this unmade TV series. Anyone want to guess how much this show cost to make?
I bet it was probably around $4 million-ish.
$3 million.
I was in the right ballpark.
Well, Lee, where can people find you online? Do you you said you're an artist, a cartoonist. Can they find your artwork online anywhere?
Yeah, you can find me at Leaster37 on all the socials. You can kind of see some of my cartoony artwork on there. That's about all I got, yeah.
You can go find Chandra over on her social medias. She's a cosplayer in the New England area. I know she's going to be at Rhode Island Comic Con coming up. You'll have to check out her various social medias to find out where she's going to be. You can find me over on the Spidey Dude Radio Network covering the Sal Buscema Era podcast, where we talk about the comic book Sal Buscema drew for the Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man series, as well as my other comic book related show, Goth Girl Horror, the Hack Slash podcast. And we're going to be covering Hack Slash Back to School coming up very soon, as well as having Tim Seeley, the creator of Hack Slash, on the show for the 20th anniversary of Hack Slash. And you can check out my own comic book, Vlada, A Dracula Tale, where we gender swap the cast of Dracula and various comic books and graphic novels and short story collections. And also, if you're interested in checking out Untold Legends of Comic Books starring Mark Gruenwald, please do shoot me an email, thatradiohorror@gmail.com, for more information about that project and the upcoming other Untold Legends of Comic movies that I'm making. And thank you, Lee, for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Chandra, wherever you are. I know you're at a convention right now, so you probably had to book it. I will be back with Mr. Zeneca hopefully soon to cover Powerless, the DC comic book show, which got canceled after 9 episodes on NBC, which was, I think, a lot of fun, but just a little ahead of its time. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
The podcast that you just heard was covering the Generation X made-for-TV movie, which was to be launched for a pilot for a TV series, which ended up getting picked up by Fox. With a little bit more money and time and effort and marketing, they probably could have succeeded with it. But they did not, as we discussed it on with my two co-hosts. But I thought I would dig into the archives of actors to see if we could find someone who worked on Generation X to come on the show with us. I was able to reach out to this gentleman, Jeremy Ratchford, who played Sean Cassidy Banshee in the movie. Thank you, Jeremy, for coming on to talk about Generation X.
My pleasure.
Where were you in your career at this time when Generation X came out? Because it looks like you had a really big boom in the 90s with voiceover roles and acting gigs and such.
It was a banner year. I did, I think, 6 movies.
Wow.
I did Fly Away Home, Moonshine Highway, The Stupids, Gen X. And it was January. We shot that in the fall. And in January, I moved down to Los Angeles from Toronto. And I actually did my looping or ADR for Gen X in Los Angeles, like 2 days after I got here. So,
when when you got the call for Generation X, had you already been on X-Men? Because it's listed on your IMDb that you were on the X-Men animated series as various voices. Who did you voice on that?
Yeah, see, this is the whole trouble. I was originally up for Wolverine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and every time I went in after that, at one point they left the mic open so I could hear them. And I can't remember who I was auditioning for, but they said, this guy sounds too much like Wolverine. And I was like, that's the point. that's the character I should have been. What else? Oh, I think I ended up a character called Cannonball.
There's a character called Cannonball. He's a new mutant. He's eventually on X-Force in the comic books at this time. At the time your movie came out, he was on X-Force with Cable, the character played by Josh Brolin in Deadpool 2. He's Cyclops and Madeline Pryor's son from the future. And let's not get into the complication of Cable. But so you were Cannonball, but that's only one episode. What? Who else were you?
That's it.
It says you were 15 episodes of characters.
Nope.
Okay, someone needs to fix some stuff on the internet then. Because I was just like, where? I could not find you in the IMDb. I'm like, where was he? Was he just various characters here and there? They were just like, shoot, you know, like because, you know, mutants popped in and out of that show constantly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Were you even aware of what Generation X was when you got the call to audition for it?
I didn't know much about Generation X. I knew a lot about Wolverine. I was a big Wolverine fan.
when you found out that it had to be that it was kind of established that the X-Men were around, but they weren't going to be in your movie, and the fact that you were this longtime X-Men character, you weren't invented for the thing, did you read up on the character?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I went and did a lot of research on Banshee and the Generation X, all the characters. It's funny because my youngest son, he's 14, he came to me and said, hey, Dad, I've been kind of researching some of your Wolverine comic books. Some of these are worth a lot of money. I was like, oh, okay. Because I don't know how many Wolverine comic books I have. And then I have, they gave us a limited edition Gen X one. And then I was approached by two guys. We did another Generation X podcast about that too, and how they're now trying. I guess there was an online attempt to try and get Banshee in the next X-Men Avengers. I'm completely lost where we're at in the superhero movie land, Val.
Well, I mean, the perfect thing that would have been the Deadpool and Wolverine movie, because that had like crazy cameos in the background from various characters. And then of course, like, there was this little group of survivors living in the wastelands trying to get away from Cassandra Nova. Cassandra Nova is the villain of Deadpool and Wolverine. She's the twin sister of Charles Xavier. And there in the wastelands, you had the you had Elektra, played by Jennifer Gardner, you had Blade, played by Wesley Snipes, and you had Gambit, played by Channing Tatum, for a movie that never got made, which was the biggest like reveal, was that Gambit is in the movie played by Channing Tatum after that movie went into development hell. So if they wanted anyone from the Generation X movie, the Deadpool Wolverine movie would have been perfect for it to be like, and who are you? Yeah. I'm from the Generation X movie.
Oh yeah, because someone said they saw it too, and it's a tribute to the 90s, more or less.
Yeah, it is. And that would have been the perfect movie. Otherwise, like, I mean, I don't know what else they would stick anyone from Generation X in, if anyone would ever want to even come back to play their character from the movie.
Oh, yeah, I'm far too old now.
So, yeah, and here's the thing. On IMDb, they list you as 18 episodes playing Banshee on the X-Men animated series. Yeah. Whoa. But you said that's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So someone needs to correct that. That's so weird.
It's been years, and I can't, no matter what I do, it's one of the first questions I get asked.
So funny. That's so weird. Where did you get the Banshee accent from? Because it's very Irish. It's very thick. It's very, like, definitely sounds like ADR. As you said, you had to ADR it.
Yeah, no, I just... What was the Daniel Day-Lewis movie about being in prison?
Oh, man. I am not a big fan of his. I'm not a fan. I just don't know a lot of his biography to know that.
I watched that a few times. I watched some Irish stuff. And again, I'm I'm a little embarrassed by the accent now because I work out with an Irishman and my sister lives in Dublin.
Oh, boy.
So I know a real accent when I hear it. I also had an English accent on an episode of The Practice.
Okay.
Which people bought. Only people from England would go, excuse me, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, that's fine. We're on a podcast. We're not broadcasting this. I do a radio show called Radio of Horror that actually broadcasts. So, but we'll if I do decide to broadcast this, just because we're going to talk about some of your horror stuff, whatever, I'll edit it out. What's funny is that we also covered a TV series on this podcast called War of the Worlds, which you were on for an episode. You're listed as student, by the way. You don't even get a name. You're just student. Do you remember that? It was a sequel to the actual original, the original movie from the 50s.
I recently saw a picture taken on that set because it was James Key, Kelly Rowan, Jason Blicker. I can't remember the last name. That's kind of a kick, yeah.
So with Banshee, your opening is this like lovely romantic scene in front of a fireplace with Emma Frost. That must have been pretty awesome because that actress is beautiful.
Yeah.
Are you guys still close? Did you guys stay in contact after that movie came out?
Yeah, we had dinner a few times and then, you know, some career changes happened and we haven't seen each other all that much, but we get the occasional hello if we have a mutual acquaintance. I'd like to reach out to her because she was wonderful to work with. I loved her.
I mean, her career was already going before that because she was on General Hospital in the 1980s and then leading into the 2000 to this very day, 1763 episodes. That is true. That is some paychecks. She's done really well. We've had multiple people on that have done soap opera stuff. It's quite amazing. So with the Generation X movie, Wizard Magazine, were you familiar with what Wizard Magazine was?
No.
Wizard Magazine was the guide to comic books. It was the premier magazine that talked about like what was happening in the world of comics, what comic books were valued. They did incredible interviews with tons of people in the industry. They were a force in the comic book industry. And almost every issue, they were always talking about the Generation X around the time of the movie, that Generation X was going to get picked up for a series. Was there any truth to that, that Generation X was going to get picked up for a series? Were you guys told that before you filmed the made-for-TV movie?
Just about everything that's ever done in show business is a potential for a series. It's insane. And that one probably was the closest I've been to that, you know, you could smell, the underground pilot. But there was a constant rumor, but nothing ever came of it.
So when the show debuted on Fox, there was so little like advertisement for it, you know what I mean? There was comic book advertisement, but the comic book industry was in a slump at the time. And then I just barely remember seeing a commercial on Fox. Were you kind of disappointed that they were not pushing this more?
Man, I don't know. Like, again, I'd done six movies that year. I moved down to Los Angeles. I was offered another television show that was shooting in Vancouver, but I didn't think it was the right option for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't think they botched it in any means. Well, I think it had potential. Like when we see what's happened in the superhero universe, it had potential to make a lot of people a lot of money. Just didn't happen.
It's just weird what shows get picked up for a series and what don't, you know? Like a couple years later, there would be a show called Nightman that came out, also based on a Marvel comic, but that was a Marvel comic that was acquired from another company called Malibu. And that ran for two seasons of like 48 episodes. It's unbelievable how long that show ran for. And it was very low budget, but it was also in syndication too. And it felt like the Fox network needed something, because they also had a Doctor Who made for TV movie that took, you know, that is considered in continuity with all everything Doctor Who related. You know, they had the David Hasselhoff made for TV movie with Nick Fury a couple of years after yours.
Yep. I was at that premiere and I nearly ran over Stan Lee.
Oh no. Wait, what? How?
It was at Universal, and I was invited, and I just remember, you know, it was a crowded event, and I turned at some point, and as I moved, I almost hit somebody, and it turns out that somebody was Stanley, and I went, "Hey, Stan." I said, I was Banshee, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I loved it." And he was on his way somewhere else. But yeah, that was the one cool thing that I had heard too. That the moment that I do my first sonic scream, and then blow the foam off my fake handguns, and put them in my holster on my side, word came back, Stan loved that moment.
Out of everything you've done, what's a favorite project of yours that still stands out that you're so glad you did it?
I got a few. I still stand behind a movie I did called Small Gifts. It's a little sweet little Christmas movie that I have a theory you can only watch Christmas movies at Christmas.
Yeah, me too.
But that one still stands up. We got second place behind The Piano at the Atlantic Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
That was quite honorable. And then... the most fun I had was that same year. I did a movie called Moonshine Highway where I play a race car driver who was an ex-Shine runner.
Uh-huh.
There was one line in the script that said, "Oh, he thinks he's Elvis." And as soon as I heard that line, I said, "I got to have this part."
You also had from 2001 to like 2010, you were working it because you had like two TV series back to back that ran for a good amount of episodes, 39 for one and then 156 on Cold Case. That must have been fantastic.
Yep.
Not having to worry about the, you know, that show was very successful, and so it kept getting renewed, and you were a series regular, so that must have been like a sigh of relief of being like, "Oh, I don't have to do a single episode. I don't have to be the one-off of One of My PD Blue or the one-off on The Practice or Buffy and things like that."
I've
talked to enough actors that are like, it's great when you keep getting the one-off episodes because the next one's right around the corner and you're going to be filming in a few weeks. But if that show gets canceled, you're done for, or they might, you know, cut you completely out of the episode and you don't get the exposure so people don't see you. But once you get on a series regular and the ratings are good, you know you can, you know, okay, I can buy this car. I don't have to worry about the payments later on.
Yeah, feast or famine most of the time.
Basically. What are you working on these days?
I'm up for, I think it's hysterical, an episode or three episodes of Tracker, and it's a retired cop that is still befuddled by one cold case. So I thought that would be hilarious to actually get on the show and, you know, be able to wink at the camera saying, "Yeah, I like cold cases." I got a project coming out in January. I just did one episode. It's a new show up in Canada for the CBC called St. Pierre with Alan Hocko. Yeah, I've had a few auditions lately. It's been few and far between. There's the industry is still, I don't know, and shell-shocked.
Yeah, I mean, the industry got hit with a double whammy within 5 years. It had, you know, it had COVID, which killed it, and then we had the strikes. Too close together, they said. It really is a game changer when two, like, things like that. And now, like, every executive is kind of afraid of something to get started unless it's a guarantee. But even, let's face it, the guarantees are not making, like, the viewership and the money they want. Look at Star Wars and Marvel, you know? Those things are hit or miss, and because they just drowned the industry with it. So, and they're not stopping either. I mean, God, they just announced, like, they announced Vision Quest, which is going to be about the Vision. He's the android. And they've got two TV shows sitting on the shelves Disney doesn't know how to put out yet, and they're not putting them out until Captain America comes out next year. And the reason why is because they're both with black leads and superhero shows, and they need to see how Captain America does with a black lead. So it's things like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's sorry, I'm getting confused here, but there are the artists in the business that love to tell story. As soon as Hollywood became like more business than artistry,
yep,
then you know, the poison starts to spread, and that's exactly, again, I can't remember the last time I was in a movie theater seeing something that wasn't superhero related. I just got so tired of it, and I've got three kids. They're now between 14 and 20, but for the last 20 years, I have been in young kid pop culture, seeing all the animated ones, all the superhero ones. But I did my guys a solid before we were going to movies or anything like that. I had acquired the old Batman series.
Uh-huh.
So they got to see the Batman that I saw, and that great 67 Batman movie where they kidnapped the ambassadors around the world and turned them into powder. Again, I don't know where I was going with this. I call it COVID brain. But
Did you just have COVID?
I may have, yeah.
Oh no, I'm so sorry to hear that. That sucks.
Yeah. Well, and it's also the other thing we got out here. I think you're also hearing and feeling. It was 114 degrees 2 days ago. 118 degrees yesterday. I haven't been out today, but it's just unbearably hot, and it affects just about everything in you.
Wow.
Yeah,
I had it in 2022. I had it one time. I haven't gotten a booster in a while. I'm really overdue. I should get a booster just to be on the safe side. But I've had it once. I had it for like 3 days. It really knocked me on my butt. Well, I hope you recover from it, because I know that can keep you off sets for a little while. Obviously, there's at least thankfully the Hollywood system seems to be very like stringent about COVID and disease these days, more than so than before, at least in America. And you go overseas, I've heard some stories, they're just like, who cares? You got the flu, get on set. that's not great at all. I mean, nobody's sick should be forced to work, let's just say, you know what I mean? And that should be a union thing too, so... I do hope you recover from it, and it's just going to pass pretty well. But, hey, man, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talk a little bit about Generation X, as well as, the fact, again, we covered War of the Worlds, but that was just funny to see that you were on that. And I'm a big fan of old cheesy slasher movies like, Prom Night and such.
That was hysterical. Yeah, that one, for Ron, they wanted to see me for the athlete. And I said I'd only audition for the athlete if I could go in first for the nerd.
In War of the Worlds?
Prom Night 3.
Oh, Prom Night 3, okay. Because again, War of the Worlds, you're just listed as a student, so I don't even know who you are, so.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, and it's a long time ago, I can't remember the actor. They brought a guy up from the States, almost like a Jack Reacher kind of guy, and I think he was on a television show in the States or the military something. And we were like six students. I just remember we were out in a location that was like a old abandoned factory kind of thing. And I can honestly tell you now, I have no idea what the episode was about. I just remember the people in it.
That's totally fine. I mean, it was so early in your career too, going to your IMDb, it's like at the very bottom. So
I think,
but by the way, you played an incredible cowboy vampire on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Bob Gorch.
Yeah, that was a memorable one, just because you were a cowboy vampire, so there weren't many cowboy vampires, so you did stand out for that one.
The spineless redneck vampire.
That was very funny. You're part of the Buffyverse. Something I'm wondering, it's like everyone wants to see a reboot of Buffy, but it's like something Disney doesn't want to touch right now. I mean, they own it, so they can do what they want with it, but for reasons why they don't want to touch it right at the moment, so we'll have to see. One day we'll see a return of Buffy.
Yeah,
they gotta distance themselves from some things about the show, so we'll have to wait and see. One day Buffy will return, so hey man, again, I hope you get better, and I do appreciate you coming on the show to talk about Generation X.
My pleasure.